see on the board. Today, 1st of March, is the last day before we break to honor the Gaur Mandal Parikram, which will end on the 9th. And then on the 10th, we'll resume this class, but that's a Friday. So that means there'll be another break for the weekend. And then Monday, we'll have class, but I believe Tuesday is Gaur Purnima. So then there won't be class on Gaur Purnima Day. And then on Wednesday thereafter, we will continue with the class until we've gone through all the material, because I just can't bear to chop it short. We thought we would just do this up till Gaur Purnima, but it's too much material. And anyway, we want to initiate adult education, so this will become then our regular afternoon class, at least for some time, even while the morning Bhagavatam class is resumed. So, are there any questions on what was discussed yesterday? This is normally how we like to start things. If somebody has a question from... No.
Yes? Just another quick summary of the question posed by the Monday Benders. And I know Bernard said I don't know the answer. And then
posed by who?
Was it Monday
Benders? No, it was Paul Kumaris. Yeah, you want to summarize their question?
Their
question was that they saw a problem in that nature is such that the mind is pervaded by sense objects because of desire, because the mind has its attachments to sense objects, and therefore the sense objects are always there in the mind. We're always remembering the objects of the senses that we like, that we have enjoyed in the past. And similarly, the sense objects are pervaded by the mind. In other words, unless our mind comes in contact with sense objects, we can't know those objects. So they saw that this relationship was just too seamless, you know? There's just no way to break it down. And therefore, their anxiety was, then how is it possible for anyone to attain liberation? Because how can the mind ever become purified if the mind seems to be... And remember, they're addressing the Creator, so the mind seems to be constructed in that way, that it requires sense objects in order to function as a mind. So then how is liberation possible, if that's what we're here for, if that's what the human life is meant for? So then you recall that the reply of the Hamsa avatar is that you're forgetting one important thing. And that's your eternal relationship with me. You're just caught up in senses and mind, which are just designations of the soul. They're not the true soul proper. Rather, they're designations or upadis that we have accepted in order to, in some way, distinguish ourselves further from Krishna, or to become Krishna, or to separate ourselves from Krishna completely. And so now we have a problem. Our problem is how to control the material nature, how to control the mind, how to control the... This becomes our problem, because those things are actually only controlled by Krishna. So if the jiva tries to step in and take Krishna's position, he immediately lands in an ocean of trouble. Because he's not actually the controller. He's not the Ishvara. And everything, you see, becomes unmanageable in his life. So I was explaining, reading from Srila Prabhupada's purport, that in actual fact we only relate with Krishna, whether we know it or not. We only relate to Krishna. So I want to give this a kind of fancy, it's not so fancy, but you may not be so familiar with this word, but it can be summed up by a word, multivalent. This is a real English word you'll find in the dictionary. The word valence means, quote, this quoted right out of, I forget which dictionary, but anyway, the one I looked at when I wrote this, probably American Heritage, which is on my computer. The word valence means the capacity of something to unite, react, or interact with something else. In short, valence is the potential for attachment, as well as attachment's opposite, aversion. You see, because it doesn't say in that definition whether the unity, reaction, or interaction is of a pleasant or unpleasant nature. It's just some kind of combining with, acting with, reacting with, you see. So, this valency then is observed in the mind, that the mind is certainly reacting to sense impressions in one of two general ways, sankalpa, accepting, wanting, desiring, icha, you see. This is nice, let me have more of this. You see this in little children, because little children are innocent and they don't see really the need for controlling their senses, you know. So you stick a lollipop in their mouth and it's nice and they want another one, you see, and another one, and another one, and you know. So it's the parents' business, the parents' responsibility to regulate these things. Sometimes a child doesn't like that, you know, that you only get one lollipop. I want more and more and more. But no, you've had quite enough. Wait till next time. So this is the mind's business, to relate to other things, either positively or negatively. But the ultimate valency is with Krishna. Now Krishna is multivalent. A thing is called monovalent when it has only one site of attachment. And for example, consider you're in a room where there's just a single electrical wall outlet. And let's say you have a laptop computer. So in that room there's only one place to plug it in. That's monovalence, you see. Unless you've got one of those multiple plugs yourself that you can plug in, and then you've got three or four, whatever. But as far as the room itself, the way it was designed, it is monovalent. There's only one point of contact or relationship possible to, for getting electricity. Krishna is unlimitedly multivalent. There's that verse Srila Prabhupada quotes, Eko Deva Nichalita Nrukta Bhakta Vyapi Hridi Rantaratmana in the Bhagavad Gita in one purport, which means there is only one God, Eko Deva. There's certainly only one God. But he has the capacity to have individual relationships with unlimited devotees. And that's what makes him God. As distinct, you know, everyone is an individual. So just the fact that God is also an individual doesn't in itself make him special. You know, that God is a single person, one person, I am also one person. That in itself doesn't make me God. But he is that one person who has, not can have, but he already has a relationship with every other being in existence. In every universe, in the material display, and every loka in Vaikuntha, every resident of Goloka Vrindavan, he has the most intimate relationship. I like that quote from the Quran. We saw in the very first day, we showed this film made by this Turkish Muslim intellectual. He's a kind of philosopher. And he makes, I have several of his films, he makes good arguments against evolution, and this one was about consciousness and how God has to be the original seer. I think he was very successful in presenting that point, which is also made in, certainly made by Srila Prabhupada, certainly made in Srimad Bhagavatam, that the creation comes to be because the Lord looks at it. He glances over it. So if he did not glance over it in the beginning, it would have no form for us to see at all. Because we do not have the power of looking at material nature and making, you know, inert pradan, the unmanifested material nature, and then agitating it, agitating the modes of nature so that all creation comes into being. We do not have that power. Only Krishna has that power. So, in that film, that was nicely explained in a philosophical manner. And then a quote was given from the Quran, in which it said, "I am closer to each one of you than your jugular vein." I thought it was really nice, because this vein in the neck, the jugular vein, is sending blood from the heart to the brain. And if that is cut off, even for as little as 45 seconds, that's enough to kill a person. So, jugular vein is then obviously something very near and dear to us, very important to us. But in the Quran, God says, "I am closer to you than that. Your life depends more upon me than that." So Krishna is so intimately bound to us. Vedaham samatitani, Krishna says, "I know every living being. I know their past, present, and future." It's not just that he knows about us now, in this moment, but he knows every birth that we have ever had, everything about it, every dream we ever had in any form of life that we were in, every impulse, everything we've forgotten, even we've forgotten so much in this life, what to speak of past lives, but he knows everything from the past, in the present, and also in the future. And yet, he says, "Me, no one knows." Because we're busy ignoring him. Srila Prabhupada used to pronounce, if you listen to his lectures, ignorance is ignorance. There is only Krishna to relate to. So he's unlimitedly multivalent. And as I said yesterday, there are basically two types of this multivalence. Material and spiritual. And we read this purport from Chaitanya Charitamrita. Prabhupada so nicely explained that. That even in the material world we find dead versions of, you know, material, gross versions of the five rasas. So everyone is really only relating to Krishna. Even if one is a gross materialist, today in our Yajna, we were discussing some names of the Lord, and he has one name, Mahabhuta. Mahabhuta. So Bhuta means material element. That is actually one of the thousand names of Vishnu, that these material elements are nothing other than Krishna. And he has another name, Sarvavidjayi. That one may think he knows everything. One may be big, big scientist, maybe Sarvavit, as he's reached the limit of human capacity to know things, you know? Like Brahma. Brahma is actually in that position. Brahma has, it is said, the jiva has maximum 78% of the Lord's qualities or potentialities. And Brahma is the one jiva in this universe who manifests that much, to that degree. Therefore, he's Brahma. He's in that position. But we've just, just reading about this question asked by the Kumaras, that stopped his intelligence. He couldn't answer. So this is Krishna. Krishna is Sarvavidjayi. That however intelligent you may be, however much you may know, you will be defeated by Krishna. And Krishna's material energy represents him. Therefore, Arjuna, we find... actually, this was the original point of this question of the Kumaras. There was a question... That question came up in the context of a question that Maharaj Parikshit asked Krishna in the Uddhava Gita. Why is it that human beings, although knowing that sense gratification leads to misery, they have... And he's actually talking about all human beings. It's not that you have to be a devotee to know that. I remember when I was in school, I was a very literate sort of person. I used to read a lot of books and poetry. And again and again, I'd come across that theme. I think it was... now I've forgotten the name of the poet. That famous British... Why worry about remembering his name anyway? We should worry about remembering Krishna. But it might come to be. Anyway, he's a very famous poet. And he wrote a poem about a ruined city that he saw in the desert somewhere, in the Middle East, I think. And the opulence, the grandeur of the city was still apparent in the ruins. You know, the fallen columns and all of that. And so then this poem was a kind of lamentation about the passage of time and how men make such great accomplishments, but then they all just become dust and heaps of rubble with the passage of time. So anyone can see that, you see, even a mundane poet. So Maharaj Parikshit's question was, so all human beings, reasonably intelligent human beings, they don't have to even be educated in Vedic knowledge, they don't have to be devotees, but if they're just reasonably intelligent, then they, as Prabhupada said, you can see that you're great-grandfather and great-grandmother died. You can see that your grandfather, grandmother died or are dying. You will see your mother and father die. What does it mean for you? It means one day you're going to die too. And on into the future, your children watching you die, they will also die. And their children watching them die will also die. Everyone dies. And yet, this was the crux of Maharaj Parikshit's question, why is it that in spite of plainly seeing this, still a human being becomes overwhelmed by his lower desires and acts like a dog or an ass, or I forgot the other animal, he mentioned a few animals there, ends up acting like some foolish farm animal, you know, just crazy after sense gratification. Why? So the answer is all found in how we relate to Krishna. Because Krishna is Sarva Vijayi. This is, again, one of the thousand names of Vishnu. He's the most powerful. And you can equip yourself with all the knowledge that's available, even Vedic knowledge. Actually, you see, the interesting thing about this name, Sarva Vijayi, is that in the thousand names of Vishnu, the names also refer to specific avatars of the Lord. There's general names of Lord Vishnu, Lord Narayan. But then there are some names that pertain, say, to his Matsya avatar, or Kurma avatar, or Varaha avatar, Nrsingha avatar. And Sarvajayi is the name of Lord Buddha. So when Lord Buddha appeared, there were plenty of highly learned pundits who were, you know, knew all the Vedas, knew all the Vedic philosophy, and he defeated them all with atheistic arguments. How could he do that? How could he do that? We think, as theistic people, you know, we think, yes, we've got the best philosophy. Prabhupada used to tell us that. So we think we're well equipped, but imagine if you had to meet Krishna in disguise of Lord Buddha at the Sunday feast. He would come in and sit down across from you. So what's this you believe in? God? Huh? Yes, there's the Supreme Personality. Where do you think it would end up? Sarvavijayi. No matter how much knowledge you have, you see, because you are a jiva and Krishna is the Lord, Krishna will defeat you. And that is happening all the time just through his material energy. That's why it's said, Prabhupada said, that Krishna, it's for his own sport that he comes. Because actually Buddha was coming to mislead the atheists. Because they were Vedic Brahmins who had taken up different forms of atheistic philosophies like Sankhya and Soin that had become prominent. And that was all being used as an excuse, as a justification for this animal slaughter, which was forbidden in Kali Yuga. But they had their ways of, you know, like crooked lawyers of talking around and continuing the killing of animals, even in this age where it's forbidden. So he came to stop that. So the atheists were there in disguise of the followers of the Vedas. So he came to defeat them and turn them into Buddhists. Whoever he defeated, he won over and made them Buddhists. So he collected all the atheists together. And then by disengaging them from Vedic Dharma, they went to hell. You see? This is how it is stated. Of course, then Prabhupada said, because he is Krishna, if they developed faith in him, then they'll be elevated. That is also there. But he came to cheat the atheists. He doesn't come to cheat his devotees. But Sarvavijayi, so simply by knowledge alone, simply by austerity alone, simply by whatever human means we may take, we cannot conquer neither the Lord nor His energy. Srila Prabhupada said Krishna's energy is simply Krishna's power. Krishna is the most powerful. So therefore His energy, being His power, is also most powerful. So we cannot conquer His energy either. It is not within human means. So if we find ourselves being conquered by material nature, then we have to look at what is the nature of our relationship with Krishna. How are we, if we give that example of wall socket, how are we plugged into Him? You see? Because everyone is plugged into Him. Everyone is connected with Him. He is within everyone's heart. He says, I am giving knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. And He will even give forgetfulness of Him. If that's what we want. You want to forget me? This is again, refers back to Buddha avatar. Oh, you want some very formidable atheistic philosophy, which by which you could totally forget about God and believe that the temporary world is it just is a standalone thing that just spontaneously arose, and then all you have to do for liberation is dismantle it with your mind, and then you're free of it. That's the essence of Buddhist philosophy. You want this? All right. Take it. He gives it. You want to forgive me? All right. So that is the question, whether our relationship with Krishna is pure or impure. So we discussed that yesterday, that because we're all relating with Krishna, I'll read this again. This was the last thing I read. As we shall learn shortly from Srimad Bhagavatam, this is precisely... Oh, wait a minute. Oh. Sorry. So now we have learned from Lord Hansa's own lotus mouth that within this world, whatever is perceived by the mind, speech, eyes, or other senses is me alone and nothing besides me. The reality of what we think about, see, and discuss is found in the transcendental dimension of Krishna's own existence. That's where reality is. That's where truth is. People talk about the truth, tell the truth, be truthful, be honest. Unless one comes to that point of truth and reality and honesty, Krishna consciousness, then these words actually have no meaning. They all become relative. Relative to something material, which means something temporary, which means something illusory. That's what Krishna says early on in the Gita. Anything that is asat, anything that is, yes, asat means temporary, not eternal, is therefore nabhava. It is not even real. He's speaking from the standpoint of eternal reality, his own standpoint. He says anything that is therefore temporary is to be understood to have no existence whatsoever. So if our truth, if our, you know, honesty, if our whatever, moral principles, we trace them back and they end up something prior, you know, something less than Krishna, then it is all unreal. And it will all collapse, as has been seen, again, if we talk about history. So many great civilizations have sprung up, existed for some time, and they have had their philosophers and their moralists and their... what is it? In the West, we always learn, what is it? The Code of Hammurabi. This king of the ancient Middle East was the first king to codify laws, something like that. So, yeah, there have been so many in history. Civilizations come up. Great civilizations, big buildings, and codes of morality and law and so on and so forth and so on. And they've all become dust. And these laws, this sense of morality and justice, it changes like a flag in the wind. You see? Like a flag in the wind. According to people's opinions, that means according to what modes of nature are prominent. So none of it is real. So then that brings up the question. Yeah, I think we talked about this yesterday. Yeah, are the mind and sense objects real? Yes, we discussed that. And we quoted Sri Prahlad Maharaj, who is saying in two verses in the seventh canto, on the one side he's saying, you are actually the air, the earth, fire, and what are your objects of sense perception, the life airs, the five senses, the mind, consciousness, and false ego. Indeed, you are everything subtle and gross, the material elements and anything expressed either by words or the mind are nothing but you. And then in case someone thinks, oh, so then Bhagavad philosophy is just pantheism, then he goes on to say in the next verse that the entire cosmic creation is caused by you and the cosmic manifestation is an effect of your energy. So this is the philosophy of Beda Abheda Tattva, simultaneous, inconceivable oneness and difference. Yes, everything is Krishna, yet at the same time Krishna, being the source of everything, is distinct from everything. And the Srimad Bhagavatam gives a very, in several places, a very easy to understand example of this. You know, sometimes people think that because of that word achincha being there, you know, inconceivable. And the Mayavadis, they have a word, anirvichaniya, which means it cannot be expressed in words. You know, if you ask a Mayavadi, what is Maya? He'll say, that's anirvichaniya. Can't talk about it. And then when the Vaishnavas say, well, that's just a dodge. That's just a cop-out. But then we have a philosophy called achincha beda abheda tattva. Achincha means inconceivable. And then some people say, well, that's a dodge too. What is this simultaneous oneness and difference? What you have to remember is achincha is the name of Krishna. That's all you have to remember. Is that achincha is the name of Krishna. So Krishna is inconceivable, but he, nonetheless, he does reveal himself to his devotees in his own form, in his own swarup, as he really is. It is not possible for anyone to know everything about Krishna. You see, even the gopis, even Srimati Radharani, Krishna mystifies her. You find that that's an essential component of their fascination for Krishna. That he is so mysterious, sometimes they're very angry at him for that. But that's expressed in the Shikshashtakam, last prayer. Whether you embrace me or whether you trample me under your feet, mat prana na tastu sa eva na pura. You are the Lord of my life. I can't, what does that say in effect? I can't understand what you're doing. I can't understand you. Sometimes you're embracing me, and this is the mood of Radharani. Sometimes you're embracing me and you say, I can't live without you, and other times you're going off with some other gopi. And this totally bewilders me and throws me into an ocean of grief and lamentation. And this is the mood of Radharani. But nonetheless, you are the Lord of my life. So, achincha means, this is the name of Krishna. This is what we have to remember. And then the Bhagavatam gives this very nice, in 3-4 verses, in different parts of the Srimad Bhagavatam, this very nice analogy, Uninabha, the analogy of the spider and the web. And this is perfectly illustrating achincha. If we take achincha to be Krishna or the spider, let's say we have a little spider named achincha, okay? You have a pet spider and you just happen to name it achincha. So we take care of the achincha problem right there. Now, let's see what that spider does. From his own body, he produces this web. Now, modern science is fascinated by spider webs. They're absolutely fascinated by spider webs. You know, this is one of the great fields, you probably didn't know this. This is one of the great fields of scientific exploration. Why? Because a spider's web is, proportionally speaking, stronger than steel. Proportionally speaking. I mean, in other words, that the weight and, you know, pressure applied to a spider, the degree of weight or pressure that it needs to be applied to a spider web to cause it to rip is proportionally much higher than that of steel. You could create a steel web and comparatively, with much less effort, rip it apart. And yet the spider web look at it. It's just this gossamer stuff, so lightweight, blowing in the, it moves with the wind. It seems like nothing, yet it's so very, very, very strong. And scientists, you can't, I've read about this. They're constantly, there's always scientists working on spider webs. Because, why? Because they want to find out the secret of how to make something like this, with which they could build buildings, so light, or whatever. So lightweight, and yet so strong, more strong than steel. That would be like a dream come true. Then, space flight, all these kind of things would become so much easier. Make a big spaceship out of spider web material or something. Very lightweight, very strong. So it's amazing. Scientists don't understand it. They're studying it constantly. And this stuff comes right out of the spider's body. So he's the source of it. The spider is the source of it. And because there's no other source than him, so it's, in a sense, non-different from him. After all, he spins the web only to serve his own purpose. And that's to catch flies, you see, for his food. And there's another interesting thing about spiders' webs, is that just like it says that Krishna is sarvagya, or all-knowing. What is that? Abhigya in the beginning of Bhagavatam. All-knowing and independent, swarat. And this is one of these two terms are key definitions of God in Vedic terminology. That person who knows everything because of knowing everything, he is independent of everything, that person is God. So the interesting thing about spider is that his web, some bug, moth, fly, whatever, gets stuck in the web. And then you see the spider come rushing full speed across the web to wrap that insect up. So what do you think, what's your opinion when you see that? You think, well, the spider, obviously, it's nature of its body, nature of its legs, is that it does not become stuck by its own web. The web will capture other kinds of insects, but the spider somehow is immune to that. Not true. Not true. Is, according to science anyway, is that along the web there are places where there is no sticky stuff. And the spider knows exactly, he sees exactly where those places are. And he's so agile, he puts his feet right in those places and he moves so fast across the web to catch the insect. Because it's by his knowledge. He has full knowledge of his web. And therefore he's never entangled in it. It's not just some gift of nature. But he has full knowledge of that web. And therefore he can move anywhere, any corner, and never be entangled in it. So similarly, Krishna has full knowledge of this material world. He's seeing this material world from inside, from outside, from all around. It's his energy, he knows exactly what it is. It serves his purpose only. And so he's, of course, not entangled in it. He's the controller of it, in full control. And we are not. So we become entangled. And then the spider withdraws the web back into his body. So Krishna releases creation. It exists for some time. He brings it back. It is not different from him yet because he's the source of it. It is different from him. And the power by which he does this, and the power by which he knows everything going on in creation, this is inconceivable to us. You see? But it doesn't mean inconceivable in the sense that it cannot be explained lucidly with an example, because Bhagavatam does that precisely with this example of the spider and the web. So this achinchya is not a cop-out. So now we want to go on to the point of Hamsa Avatar chastising the four Kumaras for their question. So because our identification with the mind and sense objects is false, why is it false? Because, again, what did Hamsa Avatar say? You're forgetting. You're so wrapped up in how to control your minds and how to control your sense objects, and why is the mind seem fits so well with the sense objects, so difficult to separate them. You're so caught up in that, you have forgotten that your real relationship is with me. That's the reality. You're eternal spirit soul. You're part and parcel of me. And liberation or self-realization or your going back home, back to Godhead, does not depend upon the control of your mind. It depends on me. So because of our identification with the mind and the sense objects is false. In text 23, the Lord mildly chastised the four Kumaras with the phrase, iti va prashno vacharambo hi anartaka. Anartaka, you know, anartha. This means that their inquiry about the self is something involved in the mutual relationship, anyonya, again that word, anyonya, of the mind and sense objects was a useless string of words. That's actually what it means. You have uselessly, anartha, without any value, you have put some words together in the form of a question. And your question really has no substance whatsoever. Because the self is never actually enmeshed in the interaction of the mind and the sense objects. Because its relationship is with Krishna alone. That's the only real relationship. You see? That's the only real truth. As soon as we start to relate with anything else, anything that falls short of connection to Krishna, and that means connection to Krishna not means yukta vairagya, as we think of it, but as Krishna accepts it. You know, we have this concept given to us by Rupa Goswami of yukta vairagya, but you have to remember who sets the standard. It's Krishna who sets the standard. It's Krishna who decides what is yukta, what is connected to me and what is not. Not us. So, you know, there are devotees who go around saying everything's Krishna and anything can be engaged in Krishna's service and, you know, whatever. But if Krishna doesn't agree, then anartha, it's useless. The self is, yes, the self is actually never enmeshed with the interaction of mind and sense object. The relationship with Krishna alone. Thus, all the talk since the beginning of history about our mental problems, about our struggles with our attachments, amounts to merely the persistence of human illusion. Yeah, the persistence of our unwillingness to surrender to Krishna according to His standard. Again, the standard that He says. How He defines yukta or yoga. Yukta is a form of the word yoga. That's why He comes. That's why He comes again and again. To reestablish that. He tells Arjuna quite plainly, because the science of yoga was lost, therefore I have come again. People don't know how to connect with me now, So therefore I have come. To make it clear again. You do it this way, you'll be connected with me. You satisfy me, then you'll be alright. The destruction of that illusion, that persistent human illusion, starts when we seek to revive our relationship with the Lord as per His instructions. In verses 39 and 40, the Hamsa Avatar approved Vedic methods of knowledge, action, austerity, culture, and so on, by which the living entity may begin to associate with Him and thus share His transcendental presence everywhere. And so this is a quotation spoken, verses spoken by Hamsa Avatar. O best of the Brahmanas, please know that I am the supreme shelter of the yoga system, analytic philosophy, virtuous action, truthful religious principles, power, beauty, fame, and self-control. All superior transcendental qualities, such as being beyond the modes of nature, detached, the well-wisher, the most dear, the super-soul, equally situated everywhere, and free from material entanglement, all such qualities, free from the transformations of material qualities, find their shelter and worshipable object in me. So again, this is the point, that Krishna sets the pace. Krishna sets the standard for what is transcendence and what is not. Not us, you know. We can't just say, well, everything is Krishna and I'm doing this for Krishna. And Hamsa Avatar said, no, it is according to my instructions, according to the values that I set down. So now we have one verse. This is Srimad Bhagavatam 11.13.30, which summarizes all the instructions of Hamsa Avatar. He says, according to my instructions, one should fix the mind on me alone. If, however, one continues to see many different values and goals of life rather than seeing everything within me, then although apparently awake, one is actually dreaming due to incomplete knowledge, just as one may dream that he has awakened from a dream. Srimad Bhagavatam 11.13.30. So again, he puts a stress on according to my instructions. The way I say to do it, you fix your mind on me alone. But if someone continues this in Bhagavad Gita, Bahushaka, this many-branched, well, yeah, okay, that's one opinion. All right, Hamsa Avatar, all right. Thank you, Hamsa Avatar, for your opinion. Now, Oprah, could you tell us what you think?
Well, I think.
And how about you, Jim and Jack and Terry and JoJo? And everyone throws in their opinions in the pot, you know. And sorry. You see, then Hamsa Avatar, then, because he's God, then he says the outcome will be that we just, the whole human. Race, I mean the whole human civilization, enters into a gigantic dreaming state due to incomplete knowledge. And just waiting for us, we'll have time to get to this, but just let you know it's coming up. We have a subheading, Human Mentality is a Passionate Dream. And this will be explained in detail, quite scientifically. So you will recall that the Hamsa Avatar's transcendental instructions are narrated by Lord Krishna in reply to a question of Uddhava about the conflicted self. How can it be that a man of knowledge is still capable of acting like a dog, an ass, or a goat? Those three animals. Dog, ass, or goat. This verse 30 above is a beacon into the heart of the problem raised by Uddhava. That person is simply dreaming, who fails to see that his immediate field of activities and the world beyond are ever within Krishna. Immediate fields of activity means this body, and then what we perceive is the world beyond. He may believe himself to be awake to some theoretic knowledge or pious conviction. In other words, he might be a good philosopher, you know, respected as, well, he's a very reasonable, deep thinker. or he goes to church every Sunday, he's a pious man, he might have these qualifications. But in fact, his spiritual nature is still asleep. Now, we all have ample experience of the craziness of the dream state. And when I wrote this, you have to understand in the context. I wrote here. Yesterday, a friend of mine told me that he dreamed of playing golf with a prominent ISKCON guru who has thousands of disciples around the world. Where he just had this dream of teeing off with... I don't have to mention it. You can probably guess who the spiritual master is. Who has thousands of disciples all around the world. Probably more disciples than any other guru in this ISKCON. So he had a dream of, like, four... I guess with a funny hat. And so, the day before I wrote this, he had told me about his dream. So that illustrates the kind of nutty stuff that goes on in our head when we dream. The prophet said the mind takes different images. So there's this spiritual master, ISKCON spiritual master, but we put him into a golfing outfit and set him out, with a number 9 club on the 13th hole. The way the mind works. So, such irrational mental imagery illustrates the power of our subconscious desires over our surface thought processes. In verse 30, the Hamsa Avatar warns us that a person who is not Krishna conscious lives 24 hours a day in such a dream world. At any moment, despite the neat structures of reason that he has installed in his head, his mind may be overcome by irrational desires. He will suddenly find himself acting like a dog, an ass, or a goat. So now we come to this. Human mentality is a passionate dream. Sounds like a headline. It is a headline. In a later chapter of the 11th canto, Sri Krishna reveals, now this is very interesting in terms of this Bhagavat science of the mind. So I hope you can really focus on this because this is real Srimad Bhagavat science. Sri Krishna reveals that beneath our wakeful thoughts and perceptions is an undercurrent of mental energy known as svapna, the level of dreaming. Which is, as we shall soon see, Srila Prabhupada identifies as the subconscious mind. This svapna is an effect of the mode of passion upon consciousness. Now there's a quote, asat svat jagrapana vidyat rajasa svapnam adishit prashvapam tamasa janto sturiyam trishu suntanam. Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th canto, chapter 25, verse 20. It states, one should know that wakefulness is born of the mode of goodness, dreams from the mode of passion, and deep dreamless sleep from the mode of ignorance. The fourth element, pure consciousness, is different from these and pervades them. You see? So the spirit soul, in his original Vasudev Sattva state, is always there. And that Vasudev consciousness is the background to whatever state of consciousness we find ourselves at any time, throughout the day. Wakefulness in the material mode of goodness, or sleeping and dreaming, or that's mode of passion, or deep sleep, dreamless, comatose sleep. The background is always this Vasudev Sattva. The soul is always transcendental. But because he's so tiny, then he becomes bewildered by these effects of the modes of nature. The soul, you see, this will... Okay, I'll give something away. towards the end of this whole thing. I'm arguing how it is the nature. If you consider, as we will when we go through this material, so many quotations of Srila Prabhupada, even direct quote, where Prabhupada talks about this directly, using the word addiction directly, as he did, for example, in a conversation with John Lennon and Yoko Ono, when they asked him, how do we know who's a real guru? And Srila Prabhupada said, find that one who is most addicted to Krishna. And then conversely, Srila Prabhupada speaks about being addicted to sense gratification. So actually, we will show when we go through this material collected from Srila Prabhupada's purports over and over again. To put it in shocking terms, it's the position of the living entity to be a junkie. He's got to be addicted to something. It's just, you know this term junkie? You know, it's a slang term. It's an old American slang term. Junk means dope, you know, heroin. So someone who has to inject heroin, who's addicted to that, would be called a junkie. So, but nowadays, this term addiction, which used to be much more narrow in sense, has expanded. Now there's all kinds, they talk, you know, popularly, all kinds of addiction. You know, there's sex addiction, there's gambling addiction, there's, I don't know, you know, whatever. Shopping addiction, I think, is now they talk about. You know, people who are addicted to going shopping. Mall, you know, in America they have these big shopping malls, so there are teenagers who become addicted to hanging out in malls, you know, hanging out in mall addiction. You know, they have a whole, you know, the range is really broadened. And practically what it means is that it is the nature of the jiva to just get caught up in some kind of ever-narrowing cycle, you see, of dependency on something. Whatever it may be, stamp collecting or whatever, you know, there's so many things people get caught up in and they spend a lot of time with it. Internet is another example. I remember when the internet started to break out and they did a report on it, and there was one woman, young woman, who was interviewed, and they asked her how much time she spent on the internet. This is when it was, this was around 95, 96, when it was still a pretty new thing. And then she told, you know, she's how many hours out of the day she spends online. And then the reporter said, well, wouldn't you say that's some kind of addiction? And she said, I'm not addicted. It's just something I have to do all the time. What is that? So, anyway, I wanted to make that point. We are dependent, isn't it? We can use another word. We are dependent. That's a synonym for addiction, dependency. So that is simply the condition of the living. I mean, not condition in the sense of being conditioned by material nature, but that is actually his position as a spiritual entity. He's dependent. He's not independent. So, a detailed understanding of these three modes of material nature, getting back to wakefulness, dreaming, deep sleep, and the transcendental position. A detailed understanding of the three modes of material nature is indispensable to Vedic psychology. But now we have to limit the scope here to the key points of relationship and attachment. That's what this essay is about. So relationship and attachment, as we know it in the material world, are features of the mode of passion. Srimad Bhagavatam 10.24.22, Lord Krishna tells Nanda Maharaj, Rajasot padyate vishvam anyonyam, again that word, anyonyam, Vividham jagat. Here again, we meet the word anyonya, by which the Lord refers to sexual relationships. Now, we started off using the word anyonya just in a very neutral sense, just relationships. But here it's taking on the connotation of sexual relationships. So the Lord is saying that it's the mode of passion that causes, number one, universal creation, number two, the sexual relationship of all creatures, and number three, all varieties of creation. In Bhagavad Gita 4.12, he tells Arjuna that as the mode of passion increases, great attachment is the result. So the material intelligence is described by Lord Kapila Dev in Srimad Bhagavatam 3.26.29. He says that its function is to distinguish between varieties of sense objects and to help the senses make choices among them. This type of buddhi, which plans our relationships with the objects of the senses, is a creation of the mode of passion. Explaining the effect of the mode of passion on intellectual activities, Srila Prabhupada states in a Gita purport, that's 1822, purport to 1822, he explains that the mode of passion gives rise to, quote, many theories and doctrines by dint of mundane logic and mental speculation. You see, so the mode of passion is what it's doing. It's increasing and increasing and increasing relationships and attachment. Relationships and attachment. In another Gita purport, Srila Prabhupada writes, there are two classes of intelligent men. One is intelligent in material activities for sense gratification, and the other is introspective and awake to the cultivation of self-realization. Activities of the introspective sage or thoughtful man are night for persons materially absorbed. Materialistic persons remain asleep in such a night due to their ignorance of self-realization. The introspective sage remains alert in the night of the materialistic men. The sage feels transcendental pleasure and the gradual advancement of spiritual culture, whereas the man in materialistic activities, being asleep to self-realization, dreams of varieties of sense pleasure, feeling sometimes happy and sometimes distressed in his sleeping condition. That's from the purport of Bhagavad Gita chapter 269. So what Prabhupada is saying here is that this very life we're living, human beings are... Well, I'll just continue reading. It's all explained here. That this is the life of the mode of passion. This is our life, O fellow human beings. Srimad Bhagavatam 3.6.28 informs us that the human species is Rajaha Svabhavena, of the nature of the Rajoguna. That is our nature. That is the prominent nature of the human organism. Rajoguna. Psychologically speaking, what this means is that we have a strong proclivity for dreaming even while we are awake. Day and night, we relate to varieties of sense objects that pervade the mind. Day and night, we form emotional attachments to mere mental images. Again, those of you who were able to see that first film that we showed, it was the only film we showed in the very beginning. How everything we're experiencing is a translation within the brain of neural electrical impulses. We have never seen light. Again, I've said this already several times. No one in this room has ever seen light directly. Because where you see light is back here, in the visual cortex of the brain, which is enclosed in the skull in utter darkness. That's where you're seeing light. So what is this light? This means something we think. We can't even prove it. Science can't even prove it. But anyway, something appears to be, you know, entering cold light into this jelly-like, you know, Nitai Gauranga explained that very graphically, so we won't repeat it. All the things that are there inside the eye. And then it's touching these nerves at the back of the eye, and that's transforming that impulse of photons striking the nerve endings, turns into what are called neuroelectric signals. And they're transmitted back into the brain, all through the brain, different places, and they finally end up back here. And that's where we see things. So no one has actually ever seen light directly. You see? So we're relating to mental images. What does that mean? Yeah, we know what it means. When you're in your bed at night and sleeping, you know, and you're playing golf with so-and-so Maharaj, and you think it's a great fun, you know. Wow, you got a hole in one, Maharaj. That was great, you know. But it's just a dream. And so similarly, if all we're relating to right now are just mental images, and we cannot prove scientifically that there's anything more going on than just mental images. We cannot prove that. Science is unable to prove that. I was seeing another... there's some film someone just gave me. It's called What the Bleep is Really Going On. And it's a film about... this is not the kind of film I would show in this class. It's too long for one thing. It's too overdone. But it's making the same point. It's got a lot of interviews with scientists. And they're talking about quantum mechanics and all of that. And they too, they're saying, the more we study matter, the more we're realizing that matter doesn't even exist. The only thing that exists is the mind. You see? And then I was reading I think it was Narada Pancharatna, Pancharatra, that Akash, the element Akash, is simply a manifestation of mind. So everything that exists materially out there is based on Akash, and Akash is an expansion of the mind of the Lord. That's why Akash has the potential for unlimited forms. Prabhupada writes that one purport, sending television images through the Akash. That's how it's possible, because there is a potential of form in Akash. So, here's another quotation. Yes, let me continue this. Day and night, we form emotional attachments to mere mental images. Remember, as was explained before, even the greatest intellects of earth and heaven, up to Lord Brahma, are unable to separate the image from the object, and so arrive at a factual anyaha, other, with whom we could have a realistic exchange. You see, it's impossible until you come to Krishna. If you try to establish the real object at any point before Krishna, what are you dealing with? What is that? What do we call it? Maya. Yeah. It's not this. This is not the truth. If it's not Krishna, it's not the truth. And therefore you're just dealing with an image. Something insubstantial. So here's a quotation from the fourth canto, ninth chapter, verse 33. In dreams we create so many things out of various impressions in the subconscious mind, but all such creations are simply temporary and unreal. In the same way, although apparently we are awake in material life because we have no information of the soul and the super soul, we create many friends and enemies simply out of the imagination. Now, you can't get any clearer than that, friends. That's Prabhupada speaking. He says, in the same way, therefore used to speak of daydream, nightdream, in the exact same way, we become attached to these imaginary friends and enemies, develop strong desires for them, especially sexual desires, or, you know, ichha dvesha, sex and hatred. And then, as happens in dreams, our lives spin out of control due to these desires born of attachment. It's getting a little dark. Can't read very well. Attempting to make sense of all this, we resort to many theories and doctrines, including those of mundane psychology. These ideas, too, are simply products of the mode of passion. You see? Like, I once read a definition of philosophy that made me laugh. Philosophy is the attempt of the mind to rise above the mind. Just had to laugh at that. So psychology is similarly the attempt of a passionate mind, a passionate, in other words, a sick, a warped mind, to cure itself. It can't be done. Another quotation from Science of Self-Realization, Chapter 7. Within this atmosphere of matter, the entire range of human activities, and not only every activity of human beings, but all living entities, is based upon, given impetus and thus polluted by sex desire, the attraction between male and female. For that sex life, the whole universe is spinning around and suffering. That is the harsh truth. You see? So this is the dream. You see, you hear, turn on the radio, you hear all these love songs. You know? It's all dreams. It's all dreams. They make it sound so nice and romantic and, you know, tugs at the strings of our heart. But in fact, it's just a big, big obnoxious dream, you see. It's disgusting. So, but let us ask, since we still have 7 minutes, who is behind this passionate attraction? So I have a Sanskrit verse here which is now too dark for me to read very clearly, but here's the translation. Although not existing in reality, this manifestation of transformations created by the mode of passion appears real because the self-manifested, self-luminous absolute truth exhibits himself in the form of the material variety of the senses, the sense objects, the mind, and the elements of physical nature. Srimad Bhagavatam 11:28-22. Here, the attractive features of creation are depicted as illusory exhibitions of the Lord's Brahman feature. Brahma Svayam Jyotir, from that verse. Sanskrit I didn't read. But another verse describes how the body, senses, minds, names and forms are exhibitions of the transcendently beautiful forms of the personality of Godhead and His divine consort. So we have to understand that there is actually, you know, I explained already the word Brahman, remember? The root meaning to flourish, to grow, and how it is illogical to conclude that this Brahman can be something impersonal. Because how can, out of something static, impersonal, passive, which is the Mayavadi conception of Brahman, how can anything grow and flourish? So Brahman has to be active. If there are relationships coming out of Brahman, then there must be relationships within Brahman. So this is very beautiful. This is from the 6th chapter, 6th canto, 9th chapter, verse 13. Guna vyaktir yam devi vyanjako guna bhavam. I know this verse, so I don't have to be able to read it. Tvami sava suratma sri sava san sri Srendriyasaya Namarupa Bhagavati Bhakti Pratyastvama Pashayata.
Yes. So Mother Lakshmi is the reservoir of all spiritual qualities, whereas you, meaning Lord Narayan, manifest and enjoy all these qualities. Indeed, you are actually the enjoyer of everything. You live as the supersoul of all living entities, and the goddess of fortune is the form of their bodies, senses, and minds. She also has a holy name and form, whereas you are the support of such names and forms and the cause for their manifestation. As Srila Prabhupada explains in the 1976 Srimad Bhagavatam lecture, there is no contradiction between the one absolute truth presented in Srimad Bhagavatam 11.28.22 and the divine couple depicted in Srimad Bhagavatam 6.19.13. These